old and you can't even drive? I can. Are you stupid, eh? Are you a stupid fool? Well, why can't you drive then? You can't even drive. It's a bit grey today, isn't it?
Well, hello everyone, and welcome. I'm here. A little bit of a delayed reaction because I was looking at the wrong screen, so I was I'm a little bit behind. Welcome. I've just come back from my trip, and a lovely trip it was too. Drinking a Nescafe Gold. Smooth. If you can see me, if you can hear me, give me a one in the chat, just let me know, because when you're on a solo stream, it's always difficult to know if anybody can actually hear you. Let me just get the complete works of Maxwell House open. I was going to do a review of Labyrinth today, but I just ran out of time, essentially, before we went. So instead, I'm going to be doing some more readings from the complete works of Maxwell House, if I can find them. Where did I put that? Maybe in this folder. Yes. Collected works. Here we go. Collected works of Maxwell House. Excellent. Okay. That'll do, pegs. That'll do. I'll use the one I used last time. Just before we get going, as people are trickling in, because this was not scheduled, I will talk about the trip. The trip was only a couple of days, Coca-Cola, because essentially our original trip was two trips back to back. We were going to go away for 4 or 5 days, have two nights in one hotel, two nights in another hotel, but because they were all cancelled and rescheduled, we did two nights this week, and then we're going to have another two nights in another couple of weeks in the other hotel, just the way the cookie crumbled. We went to a lovely place in Dorset called Moonfleet Manor. And if you've got a little one, that's a wonderful place for kids. It's very child-friendly. In fact, there was paraphernalia of the film Moonfleet everywhere, which stars George Sanders, of all people. So I've not seen it, but I've now become interested to see Sanders. And then what else? There's a number of little things interested me that could result in potential videos down the line. One is that Dorset seems to have a real kind of appetite or ethic of preservation. While we were at this hotel, there were all these different, coffee table books around. And one of them was called Cabin Porn, which looked amazing. The cabins in that book looked great. But I was flicking through this other book, and I came across this butcher that has been open since 1515 in Dorset. 1515. It's the oldest family business in Britain, or claims to be. 23 generations of butchers. That's called Balson's Butchers in Dorset. 23 generations, or possibly even more than that. And there was an amazingly based interview in this book with the butcher, who was basically just saying, like, he was lamenting the fact that, what did he say? He said, housewives these days, if it's not in the microwave, they don't want to know. He was lamenting the decline of people eating, offcuts and things like that. The interviewer asked him, he said, my son's in London, but he is going to take over the family business when I go. And the interviewer said, well, what if he doesn't? And the butcher said, well, I'd shoot him. So I enjoyed that. I really thought that was kind of special and interesting. But the other thing, when we were driving to this place, there was this estate, you know, a forest surrounded by walls, and it had like a magnificent gates, and it went on for what seemed like ages, like miles over this wall. So who the hell lives there? What is this place? And turns out it was this estate called, I don't remember the name of it now. It's called what was that estate called? I need to jog my memory. Just forget. Oh yes. Scarborough House, grade one listed building, an estate. Well, anyway, that estate has been continuously in existence since 1086, pretty much under the same family the whole time. And I just thought, well, that, I mean, okay, the butcher for 23 years, but an aristocratic family keeping like something like that going since 1086 is, I mean, I've been reading Giantano Mosca's The Ruling Class, masterpiece of elite theory. And in there, he says something like, you know, it doesn't matter the time or the place. If a family can keep something going for 10 generations, everybody will see it as an achievement, you know, much more than that. And you're kind of entering legendary status. But this particular family has been going, you know, all the way back to the Norman Conquest. And what particularly struck me is that the current resident of that house is a man called Richard Drax. His full name, to give you his full title, is Richard Grosvenor Plunkett Earn L. Drax. That's his name. So literally a quadruple barrel name. What I find fascinating is that he is literally the ancestral lord of that area in the original baronial residence that's, you know, been around since the 11th century. And he is also the MP of South Dorset, that the people of that area actually elected to choose who would have been their lord anyway, as their local representative. So I found that really interesting. And it kind of, in a strange way, I found it a little bit kind of white pilling, in so much as, you know, and that wasn't the only example. There was also this cheesemaker who was lamenting the fact that this variety of Dorset cheese called Blue Vinny cheese had was kind of, at one point it was, you know, nobody was making it anymore, and it was almost going to go extinct. And then he devoted his farm to, you know, ensuring that somebody was carrying on that tradition. And it just made me think, how could people like this, people with that kind of perseverance and endurance, possibly be conquered by the likes of the gay, you know? I mean, they, you know, some of these families will have seen civil wars come and go. They will have seen, you know, world wars come and go, industrial revolution come and go, and somehow they made it through. So it does, whenever I venture into the more rural areas of Britain, I'm always struck by just how rooted in tradition some of these areas are. And I get, it gives me some hope that these people will, you know, when the hour of decision, as Spengler put it, comes, that they wouldn't just kind of lie down and die, you know, they wouldn't roll over. So anyway, that was notes from my little trip there. Also, while I was gone, the response to Adam and Sitch has been completed, and I've now put it into a playlist on its own, just the four parts. If you want the complete saga, there's also a complete saga playlist. Now, while I was gone, I'm led to believe that Adam and Sitch did another stream in which, again, they ignored the responses that I've done, that I took time and effort to make, and instead decided to focus on the completely irrelevant comments that Sargon made on Unpopular Opinions and the little exchanges around that. So we're not dealing with serious individuals here, are we, who care about ideas, who ever cared about the what was at stake in this back and forth. What we're dealing with is people who care about e-drama, people who are, you know, looking at framing narratives, and, you know, they have consistently gone for the least relevant aspects of this to try and mine it for drama. So what I will say about Adam and Sitch at this point is that I wash my hands of this right now, because they've shown themselves to be unserious people, fundamentally unserious, non-entities, as far as I'm concerned, who do not care about ideas, who do not care about discourse, who do not care about what is at stake in these things. And at this point in 2021, we need to put those people, you know, behind us and consider them no longer part of any circles that any of us run in, because we're serious and they are not serious. They're not. I spent an hour giving them, you know, a really thorough explanation of how I've come to my conclusions. They didn't even want to watch them. Instead, they constructed some disingenuous narrative about how the quote-unquote masculine thing to do would be to have a live debate, during which people would talk over each other, wouldn't have time to prepare their response, wouldn't have time to bring up scholarly sources, you know, essentially come and do a shit show for drama and lols. So, I don't think anybody should spend any time giving clowns like that attention beyond this. On the plus side, I was just having a look at analytics, and almost 50,000 new people watch my channel as a result of this whole thing, and about just over 1,200 people decided to subscribe to me as a result of all of this as well. Obviously I can't see what their numbers are like, but from what I've seen in the comments, they seem to be hemorrhaging a good number of people, anyone who's serious, basically, over to our side of things, which is fantastic. I'm basically done with all of that now. It served its purpose, and I won't put those responses behind the paywall. I'm going to keep them up almost as a kind of like my version of Molberg's open letter, because they're all kind of nice entry level introduction to more reactionary ways of thinking, and also why we think the way we do. So I think that's that. Anybody who watched those things, you can make up your own mind. I think it's pretty obvious to anyone who's been paying attention what went on there. Okay, with all of that, somebody's saying they're worse than Vaush. I've never watched even a second of Vaush, so I can't comment on that. What I do know is that in my experience, Marxists and communists can often be serious intellectuals in a way that the likes of these two bozos never will be. So I'm always more prepared to, you know, give respect to like literally a far leftist if they're prepared to show their work, essentially. Let us move on. The next thing we're going to do here is I want to read some extracts from Maxwell House, which you can buy. It's available on Amazon still. the collected works. More people ended up buying that than I thought. And as a result, I thought, well, I'll give it another push here, given that I haven't got anything else to do. And maybe once in a while, if we're out of ideas, you know, people can pick up there. I'll push it once in a while, you know. What we're going to do is I'm going to run a series of polls, and then the polls will dictate which extract I read from, okay, which work I read from. So let's start then. I'm going to park the Adam and Sitch stuff now, if you don't mind, chat. You know, pretty much what people are saying there, there's just no point. There's a couple of other things I wanted to mention while it's still fresh in my mind, and I think saying it on a stream will make it more likely to happen, which is that next Wednesday, so Wednesday the 20th of October, is going to be Evola Day here on the Academic Agent channel. I'm going to make a guide to a buying guide to all of Evola's books, much like the one I did for Thomas Carlyle. I'm going to do a video looking at like based quotes, like I don't know, top 10 or top 20 Evola quotations, because, you know, he said some extremely prescient things. And then to cap it off, we're going to do a stream where I'm going to get Panama Hat, who knows an awful lot about Evola, to look over his life and his work, essentially, on a super stream. So 20th of October, mark it down. That is going to be Evola Day here on the... and if that goes well, we'll do more days like that. Well, we'll, you know, there could be a Spengler Day or a Giantano Mosca Day or whatever else. But we'll start with Evola Day on the 20th, because I think it will be of value to people. Yes. Okay. So, D says, I thought you were away. Well, D, I actually, because Mrs. AA booked the trip, I thought we were away till Friday, but actually we're back today, as it turns out. So that's why I'm here. I didn't even know I'd be here. So hence an impromptu stream. We'll finish up on Andy Warhol next week, and then maybe the new cycle of The Deepest Law can start after that. I do want to look at Western canon on The Deepest Law eventually, but you know, yeah, James Burnham Day. Yeah, exactly. John Sun said, I don't want to hear any more about Adam and Sitch. As far as I'm concerned, that episode is over. The arc is over. There is already, you know, you can decide yourselves who you want to listen to and support and follow and take seriously after it's all said and done. But as far as I'm concerned, the only person from their side of things who came out of it looking remotely good at all was Dev, short, fat Otaku, who, you know, originally we thought, what the hell's happened to this guy? He seemed to have really gone crazy. But I don't know if it was because he talked to Carl or something, but he suddenly woke up one day and was like, right, I'm going to do the reading. And, okay, if he reads all the books I sent him, or if he reads Evola and decides, yeah, I still don't like this stuff, then fair enough. But at least he's put work in, unlike some other people we can talk about. D saying Andy Warhol Day. I mean, I was looking the other day, D, to see when we actually started Warhol, and I think it was the summer. I think it was like literally June or something when we started the Warhol stream. So, you know, I actually think the Warhol streams are more than 12 hours. You know, they really are, you know, and we'll have to put the Warhol ones in their own playlist eventually as well. It started in July, D says. Okay, so what we're going to do is I'm going to give poll options. Which work, and people are gonna, we're gonna do lightning polls here, And then you're going to, you in the chat are basically going to decide on what gets read. So we're going to have a selection from the banana, consumed, rain that falls, and what else we got? Problem with David Hawkins. And don't worry, these choices will come up again. So if you miss yours, you know, there'll be another chance to vote. All right, which work do you want an extract read from? Let's start the poll. And while you're voting, I'll sip my Nescafe Gold and carry on talking shit. This is a kind of lazy stream, to be honest. But yeah, can you see the poll? There should be a poll now. Where's the poll? Yes. Okay. There is a poll. So, banana is... No, David Hawkins is winning. Banana is winning. More people need to vote. The banana is the absurdist play. Consumed is the kind of experimental work, I suppose. The rain that falls is the sonnet sequence. David Hawkins is the novel. I'll stop when it gets like 60 votes, let's say. All right, end. Let's end. And the winner is The Problem with David Hawkins. All right, let me find an appropriate part of this to read. So what do we want? Right, I will read some of week 8. The capital of Portugal is Lisbon. I'll read it until I get bored, and then we'll do a new poll, okay? So this is from week 8 of The Problem with David Hawkins. That summer, I was hanging out with Louis and Stevens, although by the time the novelty had worn out, I really wasn't interested in them, to tell you the truth. I spent more and more time at home and tried to exert an increasing distance between myself and my cohorts. Of course, Adam was home after his first year at Bristol, and he had already picked up that very, very annoying way of speaking when students first move away. Oh, that's so great. Everything I say is like a question, and I go up at the end of every sentence. Everything is cool or fantastic or brilliant, as if he spent so long trying to make friends that he forgot to come out of being an ultra nice dick that he becomes just to make friends and stay there. Anyway, such was things that this summer I couldn't handle being around Adam for long. Adam, by the way, is David Hawkins' older brother, okay? I couldn't help feeling that he's changed, not only in the way he spoke, but in his manner. Surely, if you are comfortable with who you were in school, then it would be logical to assume that one would return from a year away from home in an academic institution unchanged, unaltered, and yourself. Not so with Adam, it seemed to me. I resented his newly acquired character traits. Little sayings that he'd never fucking said before, such as, oh, that's grand. I mean, what the fuck, grand? And there's another one, brutal. If you ever think something was a bit harsh or hard, he'd say, oh, brutal, man. Well, let me tell you what I think is brutal, first year Adam. I think it's brutal that in school, you were never quite comfortable with who you were. That you've carved out this little niche for yourself now, finally at university, where nobody has to lick boot or climb social ladders. I felt sold out by Adam. The fact is, in university, I imagine there are no social hierarchies or dominant groups. Well, in America, maybe, but not here. He goes to school since the age of 3 till he's 18, and all the things that he has become, that his social standing has molded him into, is eradicated, transformed, fucking metamorphosized into the pseudo-Australian, positive thinking, owe that to grandstaying twat who arrived home in June that year. And then there was always my parents to turn to, them and everyone else in the town who'd nothing better to do, had all turned their attentions to a valuable cause, namely badgering a local construction company to stop them from demolishing an old bakery site. I mean, this scabby old building had been there for decades. It was totally derelict. It must have acted as a home to about a million rats. And while it wasn't doing that, it became a convenient rubbish tip in its spare time. Up until Jerry Hurtado Construction bought the site and contracted some cowboy demolition company to knock the damn thing down, everyone was perfectly content to drop their rubbish outside it, to piss on its decaying walls, or more probably just neglect it altogether. But now when somebody is trying to do something useful and probably build a nice block of flats there or something, it's the most important thing that ever graced the local council's agenda, the local church's agenda, the local primary school's agenda, my fucking parents' agenda. They had formed a rather pathetic reaction group with around 30 or so similarly aged, similarly classed people in league with the old biddies from the church group and all those other local community type people. Well, fuck them. Fuck them all. And why? Because they stand for something I hate. Small-mindedness, security and routine, all for one and one for all. Hooray. Let's all stick together and stop this old bakery from getting knocked down. And then when we've succeeded and we've got it restored, and when we've installed our burglar alarm system, enjoyed the neighborhood watch scheme, complained about people who sponge off the state but loyally pay our taxes and do our bit for society, and when we've seen our perfect smiling children through school, give them a cake and jelly for their fifth birthday, won the egg and spoon race at their sports day, congratulated them on their wonderful exam results, and we've worked 9 to 5 and just a bit of overtime for just a rainy day, a structured pension plan, life insurance, car insurance, house insurance, then we can look at ourselves and say, well, you've done yourself proud there. I've been a success. I live my life and achieve the ultimate dream, those middle-class bastions of security, family and good living. Well fucking done, Mum and Dad. You got your bakery restored. Well done. Give yourselves a pat on the back. Go on, Dad. Come home, watch the cuddly news at 6, eat your middle-class food, kiss your middle-class wife, and wait while I go off to my middle-class room and shoot myself in my middle-class head. It's not that I think the working class are any better, don't get me wrong. Like I've said, the working class are worse, if anything. Like, they actually take pride in being thick. I've spoken to working class old women, and they have an odd penchant of proud ignorance. It's a fantastically working class phenomena, that. They have their minds totally shut off from anything that they don't know. I know an old woman called Mrs. Jones. She's our next door neighbour, and often, in the summer, she makes cakes for Adam and I, and comes round and talks to my mother for a while. That's the type of person my mother is, the type of middle-aged woman who likes to talking to old people who aren't her parents, for fuck's sake. I mean, why? Why talk to old people? What have they possibly to offer, apart from telling you that things were better in their day, that kids were brighter, politer, better behaved, that you could leave your door open and nobody would come and steal anything? Well, let me tell you something, old person, there's a reason for it all. The reason that nobody would come and rob you is because you had nothing worth stealing. Did you have a state-of-the-art television, entertainment systems, multi-thousand-pound personal computers, a DVD player, and a couple of £1,000 worth of home appliances to steal? Did you? Why did kids seem politer and better behaved? Because if they weren't, their animal of a father would kick the shit out of them, and they'd have no child line to call, no nanny state to pick them up. And did everyone go around saying how wonderful children were back then? Of course not. Every generation defined itself against the past one. So it's bollocks. It's nostalgic bullshit that life was better before and all the kids were angels. The 50s kids, the Elvis generation, a nightmare for the straight upper lip and all the fuddy-duddies of the 1940s and the teddy boys of Elvis today were the squares of the Beatles tomorrow. And there were the hippies in the peak of the T-Rex and the Bowie induced glam. And where were those glitter queens and Bowie boys when Johnny Brotton brought us kicking and screaming into the punk era? Every generation of youth shocking and horrifying the staid older generation. Every older generation saying things were better in my day. There was none of this, blah de blah. So fuck you, old people. Condemn your own generation if you are to condemn anyone. Condemn the bastards who beat up their wives, the teachers who used canes, the grandfather who told you to keep your stupid head down. But you can't, can you? You're a product of all that outdated shit. And God, doesn't it show? Anyway, I wanted to tell you about the working class, not the old. Or to put it another way, I wanted specifically to tell you about working class people who take pride in their own ignorance, as embodied by Mrs. Jones. I was in the garden revising for a geography test. She peered over the wall like the cretinous 70-year-old dinosaur that she was. Hello, David. Studying hard. There's a good boy. Here she was, 70 years old. Not one qualification to her name. Not one achievement she could call her own. If you discount garnering praise for baking. Never as nice as they are meant to be. Cakes, that is. And there she was talking down to me. Me. Top of the class in four subjects, and certainly up there in the others. Essay of the Year winner for my fantastic dissection of Steinbeck's Of Mice and Men. An all-round sovereign ruler of the social elite in our school. What gave her the right to call me a good boy? Her age? Basically, that was it. Because she had the privilege of being born a few years before me, she can speak down. I was feeling petulant, so I thought I'd deviate from the usual, yes, Mrs. Jones, pleasantries. Mrs. Jones, yes, dear. You couldn't tell me what the capital of Portugal is, could you? Oh, I don't know anything like that. Okay, well, it's Lisbon. Oh, is it? Yes, Lisbon. So, do you know now? Oh, I don't know anything like that, dear. Oh, no. It's Lisbon. The capital of Portugal is Lisbon. I told you I don't know. I'm telling you, it's Lisbon. She was stubborn in her ignorance. No, she said, with that horrible working-class old woman way of saying, I'm sorry, dear, but I have to get the washing on and keep working hard. Fucking moron of a woman. No, why should I respect old people if they are thick and refuse to learn? I told her, what, four times, that the capital of Portugal is Lisbon, and she just couldn't register it. She couldn't process that simple nugget of information. Why? You tell me. Because I, for the life of me, can't figure out this social phenomenon. Another time, I remember telling this girl who I was working with at the bakery restoration, yes, I got roped into doing it, that I was reading Andrew Marvell. Andrew who? Never heard of him. She said, that classic blend of Michael Caine, Cockney, and soon to be just another single mother gracelessness. He's a poet from the 17th century. Never heard of him. Well, now you have. I ain't never heard of him, all right? Captain Marvel's son, innit? That's something else I hate about the working class, the accents. Everywhere you go, whether it's Liverpool, Wales, Newcastle, London, fucking Georgia, Alabama, the poor speak in the most atrocious and ridiculous ways. They speak like, why speak like that? People who went to school with me speak in this needlessly affected, needlessly common EastEnders lilt. Why? They had the same upbringing as me. So why speak like you came from the deepest, darkest slums of East London? I hate everything about the working class, their football chants, their accents, their fucking gaudy, I'm going to wear the chunkiest jewellery you've ever seen in your life fashion they adopt, complete with brand names in big letters across their chest, their active pursuit of the low brow and their active denial of knowledge or related to anything that their people would ask on something like University Challenge. In a word, they are thick, tasteless, and small-minded people. All right, I think I'll I think I'll leave it there from week eight. So it does go on and on and on, but there we go. Interesting, interesting. And you can see. And when I said that David Hawkins is not exactly me, you can kind of see in some of his prejudices there. So let's create another poll. So ask a question. Which work? Unfortunately, I accidentally closed the book, so I needed to get the contents up again. Um so much bile and hatred. Who do you think he disliked more, the middle class or the working class? It's hard to say. All right, so let's go for, let's give a choice of, this time, if consumed, Rain That Falls. I'll give a choice of A Falling Soul. And Freedom. Freedom is the weird kind of abstract play. Falling Soul is like this epic poem. The Rain That Falls is a sonnet sequence, and the Consumed is a kind of experimental version. If you pick Consumed, there'll then be another one. Anyway, let's have a look. Is Consumed scary? Someone said nothing like AA at all. Come on, I would stick up for, I would definitely stick up for the old woman these days. Also, I wouldn't have been, there was a lot of progressive bullshit in that little rant from David Hawkins, I would say. Lots of progressive crap that he was going on about. Peak Daria, yeah, exactly. The kind of pure, distilled, you know. Okay. It looks like, I don't think the others are going to come back from this. It's going to be consumed. So I'll just end the poll. There's no way of coming back from that. Okay. So let me have a look at Consume then. I'll pick a relevant part. Let's have a look. I've got no plan for which. Okay. Let's do Life and Recollections of Norman Lake, Ticket Inspector. Oh, well, we could. Okay, I'll give you a choice. I'll do another poll, a poll within a poll. You can have the Life and Recollections of Norman Lake, Train Ticket Inspector, the Collected Emails of Rosalind Coping, Public Relations. Or Private Thoughts of Julian Hunter, Artist. So you've got Norman Lake, Rosalind Coping, Julian Hunter. I will put those in the poll. See who wins. Norman Lake, Rosalind Coping, and Julian Hunter. Norman Lake is a train ticket inspector. Rosalind Coping works in PR, and basically she fancies this guy, and we get to see her emails essentially. And Julian Hunter is an artist who writes poetry. Well, there is no fourth option. Okay. Rosalind Coping. Let's see who's winning the poll. Looks like Rosalind Coping. Rosalind Coping is going to... I don't think the others are going to pull back on this, so let's end the poll. Okay. The Collected Emails of Rosalind Coping, Public Relations. Subject, Asking Dominic Out. Can't believe I actually asked him. Roz, where's your dignity, girl? I took my break at the same time. Well, I tried, but Richard wouldn't let me go for another 10 minutes. I sat down near him, but I couldn't think of how to start the conversation without sounding like a silly little girl. He smelled lovely. I think he was wearing Aramis. He was wearing that navy suit he always does in work, with his two top buttons undone. His hair sort of droops like Leonardo DiCaprio's, only darker and more wavy. Probably more like David Ginola's, thinking about it. Anyway, he was basically sex on legs, basically. I was sitting there with my jacket potato and felt my face going red and hot. No one else was there, and he wasn't really saying anything. Hey, I said. It was so awkward. My hey was really weak too, like my voice was faltering. I tried to cover it up with a little cough, but the embarrassment was obvious. Everything all right? He spoke, a voice smooth as velvet that shuddered down my spine. It's got that deep English quality where he draws out the long vowel sounds. Yeah, I said, trying not to sound pathetic. How are things? Who is it you're working on? I'm promoting a group of conceptual artists or something. Don't suppose you've heard of any of them? Richard Long, Julian Hunter. Shit. I thought now I'm going to seem like a stupid girl who can only type and do what Richard tells me. What was I meant to do? In the few microseconds between answering naturally and an awkward silence, I contemplated pretending to know all about them, just a plain no, or pretending I was really interested before I answered he cut in. I don't know, pile of wank really, part of the firm's plan to diversify. Now was my chance to chuckle at his superior wit, so I did. He didn't laugh himself, but sort of shrugged in a nice way. I'd got past the initial break into conversation barrier. Now I just had to keep it going long enough to ask him. I was consciously trying not to play with my hair. You know when I pull on it when I get nervous? The onus seemed to be on me to speak next. So, how are you going about it? That seemed like a natural thing to say. You know, the usual. For these art things, specialist magazines, those little leaflets in museums and big signs outside the exhibition. It's a dramatic change to what I usually do. The way he said dramatic made him sound so intelligent. I could feel myself falling in love, gazing into his eyes on a starry night in heaven, sipping wine and making the sort of witty quips my mother would have been proud of. Yeah, sometimes life can get too monotonous, I said. Sometimes people just forget themselves and do the same thing every day. That's why I got into this line of work, he said. You've always got something new around the corner. The buzz is always there. This was starting to get profound. We were starting to talk about things I actually believed in. Speaking of which, he said, I have to go. The buzz is calling me. I had to act quickly, but before I reacted, he'd gone. I was left with my potato to figure out what to do next. Till next time, Roz. Subject, Wednesday night. I'd missed the perfect opportunity to ask him out for dinner, and he was too engrossed in his work to ask him in the office. Richard was being sleazy today. He calls me Rose. All right, Rose, how are you coping? I feel like spitting in his fat face sometimes. That little goatee beard he's grown really gets up my nose. It only makes his chin look fatter. Anyway, I had to meet some new clients, so I wasn't in the office long, thank God. I got in early as a result and fed the cat early just to get it out of the way. I was trying not to think about Dominic, so I did all those things you do to get your mind off something. I watched a video, but it was 4 weddings and a funeral, and obviously I spent the whole time comparing Dominic to Hugh Grant. He's a lot less stuttery than Hugh and broader. Remember when we used to watch this film just to get all teary and love Hugh Grant? Anyway, then I phoned Debs to tell her about what happened yesterday, which didn't really get my mind off it. I miss you sometimes. You were always good at getting my mind off things. When we used to play Scrabble, and I always won. But when I used to try on every single skirt and dress that you had. I've still got the red next one, by the way. I went to bed eventually, but he was totally consuming my thoughts. I was just imagining him without his shirt on. Think of those Diet Coke adverts. I won't tell you the rest. Miss you always, Roz. Kiss, kiss. Subject, Dominic on the train. I got on the train to work, and oh my God, he was sitting there opposite me. There was this rather loud man arguing with the ticket inspector, though. He was going on about everyone getting charged double the fare or something. What this meant is that because everyone else had gone silent, I couldn't approach Dominic. The ticket inspector had a very tired look about him, like he'd lost the will to live, and the man was incessantly shouting in his face. He was annoying me quite a lot, actually. And out of nowhere, I stood up, marched up and said to him, excuse me, I'd like a bit of quiet before work. So could you please calm down and give us all a break? The man was momentarily dumbstruck. And in the triumph, everyone else started clapping. What a surreal moment and how embarrassing. I sat down, not knowing whether to bow or just to feel stupid. Dominic looked at me and smiled. That was quite a stunt there, he said. I just tried to smile and said, not in a contemplative way, but in the sort of I agree way, but it's not going to say anything sort of way. When I gathered my thoughts, I said, so where have you been? You're not usually on this line. Oh, I've been to Gina's for a couple of days and she couldn't give me a lift this morning. My heart sank. I felt the blood draw out of my face. Sorry, I have to go, I said, without thinking, and quickly got up and went to the toilet. The tears streamed down my cheeks, my mascara leaving my skin sort of gritty. I couldn't go back out there looking like this, so I stayed in the toilet until I got to work. I did the best I could with a few bits of cotton wool I had in my bag, but I couldn't dab cotton wool on my heart. I was truly crushed, as if my reason for living had just been removed. I deliberately went out through another carriage and in work angled my chair so I couldn't look at him. Why is it in my life that whatever you want, you can't have? Like chocolate, you love it, but you can't have it. Look, but don't touch. Well, I'm sick of looking, Lucy. I'm sick of living on my own. I'm sick of Richard looking at my ass. I'm sick of promoting other people. Why are they so much better than me? Why can't I be the one who gets promoted? I'm thinking of getting transferred to admin because some of the people I'm working on depress me. Why did he have to have a girlfriend or fiance or wife even? I'm not looking forward to work the next few days. He's going to think I'm a right weirdo. I'm clearly overreacting, like, right? It's not like I actually asked him to go out or anything. He's probably just thinks of me as just another girl in work. I better go. Pig face. Richard is coming. Till next time. Roz. All right. I think that'll do from there. Okay. Let's have another little... let's have another poll. So that was from Consumed. Let's try. Okay, I'll put the rain that falls in. Never going to get picked. So let's sequence the rain that falls. But okay, the plan, the strange kind of couples warring thing, and I'll put what else can we put in there? I'll put the Consumed radio play version. Radio play. Normal. Which one? Have a look. Okay, leave the votes get up to I could see someone in the chat picked up on the line. I couldn't dab cotton wool on my heart. See, the thing is, you have to get into the mindset of your characters. I like to think that, you know, the 19 or 20 year old me wrote that line with love rather than with contempt. Let's have a look. How's this poll doing? Oh, it's close. It's close. Let's see if I can get to 50. People laughing that everybody clapped. Oh, I'm loving the chat. I've decided now that after this finishes, I'm just going to go back and reread the chat, because some of these are okay. It looks like The Rain That Falls has won after I said it's never going to win. So, okay, this is the sonnet sequence. The Rain That Falls. Let's see, this is a rather different mode of writing. I think I read The Tomb already, didn't I? So let's just start then. Okay. So this is the second sonnet here. Fateless path in the void. In stasis the moment does hold, for all time and for us to see. The soul drowns so that we can be a dream, an epoch to unfold into the shifting stars. The cold, our enemy, freezes the glee of the boastful heart that beats free, the beat of the stories untold. This love of ours, the moment makes of peace, of harmony, of war, the turbulence of storms that brew. Glorious fate my life forsakes and forges its path on all fours, transgressing the void on love's dew. Okay. And then the next one in the sequence is called The Kiss. I'll just do a few in a row, okay? We kiss. Your lips become sweet cherry red. Your tongue in my mouth. The words that you said are held by my words. Thus silence is shed and truth is consumed by the greater truth. Each creak of the bed betrays what we share. Words best left unread. As words and feeling and meaning unwed, then bind and life's resumed. The moment is over now, we can think, which twists and mangles my heart into yours and wrenches it dry, like sweeping wind sink, into the abyss whence the demon roars. We then laugh, we then weep, like balls on chains, the pendulum swings from the fulcrum flame, where night ravens perch, where the dove is slain, where chaos reigns, where two souls are the same. So that is the kiss there. And just having a look, you can see that I'm playing with, that was an Italian sonnet, I believe, or a variation on the Italian sonnet, because it goes, because of the, it ends with the it ends with six lines, you know, the set, whereas the English sonnet ends with a couplet typically. So that's an Italian sonnet, the kiss there. All right, number four, coffee. We went for a coffee to discuss our future together, why it doesn't work, your concerned little face, perplexed flower, pierce my rationale, foot into dirt, precise argument, all turning to dust, desire your legs, all turning to lust, clothes become a hindrance, knickers and all, rewind to when we had sex in your hall, sex in the kitchen, on the bedroom floor, over the table and against the door, sex in the night, in morning some more, over and over and then on all fours, drinking that chocolate, trying not to care, to tell you the truth, I could have shagged you there. So a different variation of the sonnet there. That one basically about trying to have a coffee, but, you know, the mind becoming distracted, so to speak. Number five, sleeping with you. Nothing like seeing you through the thick dark, your skin just a shade buried in the black, the whites of your eyes piercing and marked by their vulnerability in the black night, where we're embroiled like flames in a fire, deep within the burning brain of the black jaguar that bursts ferocious and wired out of the billowing bowels of the black lightning that strikes when two souls can collide, the vicious storms that swirl out of the black caverns of desire that dwell inside the fragile heart, the nights fades, day's dawning, nothing like seeing you in the morning. So that one was sleeping with you. Shall I carry on? These are kind of interesting, these sonnets, aren't they? So the next sequence within the sequence is called The Demon. And then it goes, The Rogue's Gallery. Roll up, roll up. There's a free shot to take. Up stepped a stranger, face buried in mist. Bullseye. Well done, sire. Good prizes at stake. He held you in his arms, and there you kissed. Calling Rogue Two. Sir, please come to the store. Up he stepped out of Enid Blyton books. Blondie, brown, well-built, tall, funny and all. Direct hit, my word. Please take it by your looks. Room for one more. Hail. He's not quite dead yet. There he came, big-eared, Italian grin, with devil's beard, hair, a greasy jet. Don Juan, please have her as ever you win. There my trust lay, as a rat's carcass dead. There the demon came, emerged from my head. And then the carnival. Calling all stags, get out your flags, the princess is in town. Get on your knees, eager to please, and she won't bring you down. Let us rejoice, in chorus voice, the pauper prince has fled. Quick in pursuit, put down your lute, to get into his bed. With red eyes, he watched on the mountain, spanned his horror wings, and flew to the scene. Whilst the prince sat at the disused fountain, waiting for a drop, feeling only green. The princess, she danced with sovereign air, taken by his teeth, his strength, his strange japes, his juvenile wit, his shiny short hair, his broad rugged frame. How could she escape? How could she refuse? How could she lose? He bottled it up and pickled the bruise. Shall we stop there? No, I'll carry on going for a while. The interloper. I woke in a sweat. Worries could come true. I dreamt last night, nightmares made of you. And that obsessed pipe dream hoper jumped up greasy interloper. His face nestled up to yours, and that drew bitterness and wrath and turmoil that stewed. Until explosion, I spoke the furnace of conflict. I poked the fur-chinned contender, upstart pretender, punched him till he bled, ripped his bleeding jaw, took a fist of bile, drove it through his teeth, stood atop the cliff, took his surrender, the hemlock of victory, freed it poor on primordial jealousy, love's belief. And then The Rain That Falls, I guess the title track, if you want to put it that way. I sleep, slip the shore as salvation slain. I creep across chasm crags, the kin of Cain. I weep with withered woe as willows wane. I reap the wrath of the rancid, raucous rain that falls, fraught with fear like failures frail that falls, from frenzied fury's faithful flail that falls, like fangs fretted fortitude fails. The blood that draws, drips, bubbles round, like venom penetrates the ground, like molten hatred without sound. I blow the bitter breath on bloodied bark, I sow the sullied seeds of suffering stark, I drown neath the dank and dungeon demizens dark, I drown, drained by the demon's deathly dark. And then it goes on and on. So I think I'll stop there. So those are some sonnets from the rain that falls, which were interesting. I seem to remember that this was written in a. Do you remember in Friends when Ross said we were on a break? Do you remember that? We were on a break. Do you remember that whole thing? I'm pretty sure that all of those came when we were on a break, so to speak. So there we go. Let's have a go for the next. I mean, somebody's saying turn them into a prog thing. I mean, they could easily, you could easily make them into. I reckon you could make it easily in a heavy metal album or something like that. Anyway, you're like a double LP with Snow That Falls. Okay, let's go for. Which one? Let's go for Decay. Let's go for The Plan. I think this will be the last one. And then we'll I'll bow out there, I reckon. Decay, the plan. We'll go for consume the radio version again. Radio version. And then go for the snow that falls. The follow-up and much bitterer Sonic sequence from years later. Sorry, I just received an email. I love it when people send emails like that. I just received an email from I won't name who it is, but somebody fairly well known. Just one word. Wankers. I love it. I love emails like that. It's a one word email. Yes. Which one's winning? Decay is winning. It's possible that there'll be a comeback if we get up to 50 votes. I tell you, people are debating the influence of various different people on my sonnets. I mean, it really depends on the sonnet in question, because I played around with many different forms at that time. But where was the bit which went? Hold on. There was a bit that I was like, yeah, I know where you got that from. Where is it? Yeah, so there's a technique known in poetry, right, as enjambement, right, which is when you break off the line and continue the next line. It's called enjambement. And in rap, Jizza Genius from Wu-Tang Clan loves using enjambement and breaking the line in a really unusual place, and but still rhyming. So like in Breaker 1-9, for example, let's see if we can bring up those lyrics from Jizza here. In Breaker by Jizza, he says, hold on. Okay, so here's a perfect example of enjambement. He says, in the bottom of the bomb shelter, still felt the heavy blast that blew off the mast of 12 welders. Now note that the still felt the and heavy blast is that's a run-on line on an enjambement. Very, very clearly, I stole that technique when I went, I spoke the furnace of conflict. I poked the furching chin contender, upstart pretender. That spoke the and poked the is very, very Jizza inspired. Yes. I mean, it's very, very obvious when I look back where I'm getting certain things. Most of my influences, I have to say, are not from popular music. They are from actual literature. But there we go. All right, so enjambement, yeah. Okay, so which one? It is Decay that has won. We have reached the 50 mark. Del Boy pronunciations, yeah. I'm not good at doing French words, so just assume it's wrong. However I say it, it's obviously wrong. All right, so let's do a bit from Decay. I might even do a bit of dialogue. Yeah, let's do some dialogue, shall we? Okay, I'm going to do scene three. Scene three, and then we'll see what else we fancy doing. Scene three. Andy is on the plane on the way to Oxford, England. He is ready to read for a PhD in political theory at the university there. Presently, an air hostess is making her way down the aisle. Andy occupies a window seat. Next to him sits an obese 20-something with a beard that is not thick enough to cover his double chin, and evidence of egg stains down his faded Black Sabbath T-shirt. Andy contemplates him momentarily before realizing that he probably isn't worth the hassle of engaging with, and turning his attentions to the window. Finally, the air hostess arrives to address the obese teenager. So the air hostess, she is British and fairly well-spoken. "Can I get you anything, sir?" This is the obese teenager. "Yeah, I'll have a can of Coca-Cola and a bag of potato chips." Air hostess: "What flavor of potato chips? What would you like, sir?" "Potato, like, come on." "You mean ready salted?" "Well, what flavors do they come in? Like, come on. We have cheese and onion, salt and vinegar, prawn cocktail, and ready salted." "Prawn? Like, come on. That's totally not okay." Andy leans over. And Andy says, "You know, I read that Ozzy Osbourne likes to eat prawn potato chips." A beast teenager: "Yeah, but like the Ozman is like, yeah, come on. I'm totally not eating prawn potato chips." The air hostess, starting to lose patience: "In that case, sir, can I recommend the ready salted?" After his small contribution to the discourse, Andy has retreated to his posture of window gazing, perhaps a quick pan over to register his secret self-satisfaction with his contribution. A beast teenager: "You got any peanuts?" "Yes, sir. Which variety would you like?" "Well, what you got?" Air hostess, with a slight sigh: "Salted, dry roasted, honey roast, and mixed with cashew nuts." Andy, leaning over: "You know, Ozzy Osbourne likes honey roast." A beast teenager, slightly aggrieved by Andy's second interjection, reasserts his authority: "Give me the salted." Air hostess, attempting to punish his obstinacy: "What variety of cola would you like with that, sir? Regular or diet?" A beast teenager: "Just a Coke will be fine, thank you." Air hostess: "Will Pepsi Cola be all right, sir?" A beast teenager, his temper lost: "Like, come on, that will be fine, thank you." The air hostess goes to her trolley to get the product. The obese teenager regards Andy with an air of smug satisfaction, seeing this final act of submission by the air hostess as a victory of sorts. Andy looks to the window once more. The air hostess serves the obese teenager before addressing Andy. "Air hostess, and for you, sir?" Obese teenager, rudely interrupting: "I'm sorry, but do you have any ice for this Pepsi?" Air hostess: "Yes, sir, in a moment." Obese teenager, pushing his luck: "And a straw as well, please." Air hostess: "Yes, sir." Andy, attempting to achieve some sense of rapport with the air hostess: So this is Andy. "I'll just have a coffee, please. Black, one sugar." Air hostess can't wait to move on: "Yes, sir." She goes to the trolley. The obese teenager loudly opens the bag of peanuts, in the process dropping some on the tray in front of him. Andy discreetly watches him. The air hostess is ready. She produces the coffee and a glass filled with ice and a straw. "Air hostess, there you go, sir. And a coffee for you. Have a nice flight." She moves on. Andy is left with the obese teenager noisily eating peanuts, who swigs his Pepsi and loudly belches. Andy fiddles around for a pair of earphones, plugs them into the arm of his chair. Scene sounds fade out, and Duran Duran's "Save a Prayer" comes booming through. Hold shot of Andy listening to the music for a moment before a cut to the first montage sequence. Footage of Ronald Reagan in conference, Fidel Castro, mass Cuban immigration to Miami, Florida, Al Pacino with Scarface. Jump back to Andy looking out of the window. "Don't say a prayer for me now. Save it till the morning after." As chorus goes into synth sequence, cut to the second montage. Footage of the 1979 Iranian Revolution, Khomeini, Iranians beating their backs, Saddam Hussein, Reagan in conference, missiles, marching Iraqi troops, oil tanker exploding. Cut to footage of Japanese businessmen, Italian football team with Jules Rimet trophy, Hulk Hogan as wrestling champion, waving an American flag, stockbrokers in Wall Street, Dick Cheney meeting with the House of Saud, famine in Africa. Jump back to Andy, scratching behind his neck. "Don't say a prayer for me now. Save it till the morning after." With the second synth sequence, start third montage, footage of Osama bin Laden in Afghanistan, Taliban firing missiles over Soviet border, cut to stock footage of Lenin addressing crowds, close-up of red Soviet flag, cut to footage of women with perms and shoulder pads, Boy George, Village People, Freddie Mercury, Michael Jackson, Sly Stallone, Ronald Reagan at a conference, cut to footage of Margaret Thatcher making a forceful speech, footage of Diego Maradona playing football, Thatcher, battleships near the Falkland Island, images from Evita, Thatcher, battleships firing, Thatcher, overhead, shot of Oxford, town of wandering spires, jump back to Andy, who is now sleeping. The song should have finished, fade to black. I think let's do the next scene as well before we get out of here. Scene 4. Andy is in Oxford. He is in the main hall at Oriel College, a very large room with stained glass windows and paintings of dead white men on the wall. Amongst them, Sir Walter Raleigh, Cardinal Newman, John Keble, and Matthew and Thomas Arnold. Down the middle of the room are three long tables, each flanked by long benches a la Harry Potter. At these tables are sat rows upon rows, six in total, of young men in tuxedos, over which they wear academic gowns. At the head of the room, under a massive portrait of Edward II, and on a raised platform, is high table, at which are sat six Oxford dons, all white, all male, and in their 60s, if not older. The boys are singing or shouting toasts of rowing victories. Floreat Oriel. They are teetering on becoming rowdy. They are eating dinner. This consists of game, perhaps pheasant, roast potatoes, roast parsnips, and broccoli, all of which is covered with gravy. Andy is sitting in a corner seat and does not appear to be enjoying himself. He is clearly not a part of the present celebrations. After the camera has established this, it should survey the faces of the dons. The following descriptions should be apparent with only a shot or two. As the camera moves from face to face, each don should say, "Yes," in a crisp and posh Oxfordian accent. An ambitious director might wish to employ freeze frame here, with captions such as "Prof Hartley, Provost and Economics Tutor" appearing on the screen, but this is not absolutely necessary. Sitting in the centre of the table is the Provost, Malcolm Hartley. He is of robust frame, without appearing overweight, and his face bears the marks of 1,000 parties and candlelit dinners with wine. He is the picture of middle-aged contentment. Perhaps his nose is starting to redden. His subject is economics. To his left sits Professor Goldsmith. He is older, fatter, redder, and more opinionated. His subject is history. On Goldsmith's left is Professor Kirby. He is very old, with a white moustache and glasses. He shakes with age. Kirby teaches medieval English. It should be noted here that Goldsmith makes no attempt or effort to speak to Kirby and sits almost with his back to him, facing Hartley. To Hartley's right is Professor Simpson. His face is gaunt and dusty, and his body thin and skeletal. He wears round, steel-rimmed glasses and is rather austere in demeanour. He lectures in politics and is Andy's supervisor. To Simpson's right is a more obviously outgoing character. His head is bald and his nose is bulbous and red. This is Dr. Graham, who teaches mathematics. To his right is a much younger man, possibly in his late 30s or early 40s. He is thin and effete, with arched eyebrows and a pouting mouth, and his expression is one of almost permanent disdain. He wears a sharp navy blue pin-striped suit, which stands out. This is the college's resident theologian, a man of supreme intelligence and a barbed wit. Presently, Goldsmith has raised his wine glass and clinks it with a spoon for Hartley to make a speech. When there is a silence, Hartley rises and addresses the room. Hartley, "I've never liked making long speeches, and I'm not about to break the habit of a lifetime now. All I wish to say is that you boys are all very privileged to be studying at an institution of such world renown, and that this college, which has stood for 700 years, is privileged, no, honoured, to be the home of such a collection of talented and intelligent individuals." There is cheer and applause. "I know that all of you are currently engaged in the various stages of inebriation and that inevitably follow victories on the river. I remember once that I sat there where you are now sitting, listening to an old fool like myself speak of pride and privilege. You will remember these days for the rest of your lives. All I have to say as provost is make sure you work hard and as far as possible enjoy life while it lasts at Oxford. Your experience will be uniquely your own, but I can promise you that you'll keep it with you for the rest of your lives. So there is little left to say, but Floriette Oriol. And everybody raises their glasses. As the toast reaches its climax, suddenly somebody throws a potato across the hall. At this, the Dons start, and suddenly Hartley bangs a hammer on the table and a deadly hush comes over the room. Hartley rises once more and climbs onto the table. The silence goes from one of fear to one of complete bemusement. Hartley, the boy who threw that potato, rise at once. The guilty party rises to his feet. Where did you learn to throw, boy? Do you think this is a girls' college? Hartley bends down to pick up a potato from his own plate and hurls it at the boy, hitting him in the face and leaving some residue on it. The entire hall erupts in a cheer and a massive food fight starts, and the Dons all join in. Andy does not join in, although he does get food thrown at him. Sorry, something just made me laugh. At one point, a potato hits his glasses. Sorry. His general air is one of shock and bemusement. The screen fades as the food fight rages on. So there we go. I think we will leave it there. All right. I think that'll do, ladies and gentlemen. I will just check to see if there's been any super chats. Sorry, it's just poor Andy. He's always the victim in every scene and scenario he's ever in. But then again, that is decay. All right. Drongo says, I mean, who talked to an old man? Norm MacDonald. Well, there we go. Drongo, I disavow the views of of David Hawkins. All right. So I hope that was enjoyable for people. You can get the collected works of Maxwell House on Amazon. There's a link in the show notes. If you'd like to support this channel, you can join it. You can buy a mug. You can get a course at the Academic Agency, 25% off at the moment with Autumn 25. If not, I'll see you all tomorrow. We're back with a cigar stream. The reading this week is up. I put it in the community tab. You can go over to Skeptical Waves to listen to that. And most importantly of all, get out.